New laws will change some aspects of life in California, though at least one of those laws will be challenged in court. On Insight, Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler highlights some of the high-profile signings by Governor Jerry Brown, including the net neutrality bill, which quickly triggered a lawsuit. Then you'll hear part of a new episode of Cap Radio's political podcast, Keys to the House. In this excerpt, a look at which congressional House races in California are most competitive. Tara Lopez is here with us to update us on her duo with Adam Pierce, Rituals of Mine. They have a show tonight, which we'll talk about. And we're going to finish the hour with live music from the experimental rock band Gentleman Surfer. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. For one final time, Governor Jerry Brown has finished that end-of-session process, deciding whether to sign or veto the hundreds of bills passed by California lawmakers. The governor's reported to have signed 1,016 bills into law. He vetoed 201 bills, including one that would have required the testing of all newly collected rape kits. He vetoed another bill that would have required California's public universities to offer abortion medication. I talked yesterday with Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler about some of the more high-profile decisions made by the governor in his final flashes of the pen. Here's Ben.
Leave it to Jerry Brown to clear his desk by issuing one final signing statement that includes a biblical reference, in this case, Exodus 22:25, and end it with, and now on to the promised land, Colusa County, which of course is where his ranch is. The governor, in his 16 years in office, acted on nearly 20,000 different bills, 19,436, if my math was right. And this year he acted on 1,217 of them, which is the most in his most recent stint in office. He signed over 1,000, vetoed a couple hundred. His veto rate was 16.5%. It was actually his highest of his 16 years. So Governor Brown going out in Jerry Brown style.
Before we get too far away from that tweet, which also included hashtag Eureka.
Yes.
Which was fun. There was a video montage of a lot of signings and scenes. And of course, we didn't have social media and probably didn't have the video recordings of some of those bills back in the 70s. I don't know. But the picture of the totality of it, nearly 20,000 alone, could be a piece of compiled history that I think will be a work in progress for you. Right.
As long as we don't use the word legacy, Jerry Brown will be OK with that. But you, right. You can't escape the fact that this man has been governor of California for 16 years. His father was governor for 8 years before that. The Brown family has had a disproportionate influence on California, perhaps more than any other family. This governor may have had more influence than most, if not all, governors of California.
Tell me about some of the statements he made in signing the bills. I talked with Ken Rudin, the political junkie, about the signing of SB 826 because he copied the Senate Judiciary Committee in his letter on that one. Was he more expressive this last time than he's been in the past?
That's a good question. I think you'd have to ask his staff how this year compares to other years. My sense as an onlooker is he may have been a bit more reflective than before. I don't know that he would have issued a signing statement that was a page long about a bill that would increase the maximum dollar amount of loans permissible under California's pilot program for increased access to responsible small dollar loans.
That became the last one.
That was his final bill. He posted the signing message on Twitter, his office did, and that's where he quoted Exodus and talked about lending money. Thou shalt not be to him as an usurer. And I think it's hard to imagine him doing this in 2011. Is this because it's his final year? I think maybe there was a sense
of... I'm going to take that as a yes.
Yeah, I think it's probably safe to say that he decided to go out in his own fashion.
Well, let's talk about some of the major bills that he acted on over the weekend, and in particular Sunday, which was the last day of signing, some of which are getting national attention, which isn't surprising because California has positioned itself that way. And it seems the governor has at times delighted in being in that role. So where do you want to begin on Sunday?
I think we have to begin with net neutrality because
that is getting the most national attention right now.
And from the Trump administration, too. And I think that's why it's getting so much national attention. So we're talking about a net neutrality bill by Democratic Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco. This is a measure that industry groups fiercely opposed in the form that it was in. They tried to weaken it. They succeeded for a time, but the bill was later restored. The argument is over whether the measure does or does not take the Obama-era net neutrality regulations and put them in place in California. Critics say the bill goes actually further than the Obama-era regulations. But I think the fact that the lawsuit came so quickly, the Trump administration and the Federal Communications Commission, they were planning for this, obviously. They were expecting it. And so I don't think their complaint is that it goes further than the Obama-era regulations. I think their complaint is that a state is trying to regulate the internet, and that is a federal government power, the federal government believes. And so we will see how this case turns out when it winds its way through the court. So I think that's what got so much attention. A brief statement from Jeff Sessions, the attorney general. Under the Constitution, states do not regulate interstate commerce. The federal government does. Once again, the California legislature has enacted an extreme and illegal state law attempting to frustrate federal policy. This battle far, far from over.
It did sound as though the governor signed the bill and immediately someone just pushed send to file the lawsuit. But the governor
here in Sacramento, by the way,
signed this bill without any comment, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. And the vast, vast majority of bills he signs are without comment. The signing statement that you talked about with Ken Rudin about the Women on Corporate Boards bill is an exception. The final signing statement, I think, was more just, the governor's way of going out in Jerry Brown fashion. Most bills, vast majority of bills, he does not issue signing statements for.
Let's talk about the group of bills that would be under that umbrella of the Me Too movement.
Sure. He has been known for, as he says, paddling a bit to the left and a bit to the right. The thing about these Me Too bills is many of them drew concerns from business groups. One of them was labeled a job killer by the California Chamber of Commerce. In fact, the only bill to reach the governor's desk was this bill that would have banned employers from requiring workers to participate in private arbitration to settle disputes like sexual harassment claims rather than going to court. It was authored by Democratic Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher of San Diego. Brown wrote that the bill plainly violates federal law, and that was why he vetoed it. He also vetoed a measure that would have extended the deadline to file a harassment or discrimination complaint with the State Department of Fair Employment and Housing from 1 year after an incident occurred to 3. And his veto message there, the governor wrote that the current filing deadline, quote, ensures that unwelcome behavior is promptly reported and halted. I think that veto message may get some pushback as well. But then he turned around and signed a bill by Senator Connie Leva of Chino, which bans non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment, assault, and discrimination cases. So you will no longer be able to make someone sign an agreement where they promise not to talk about the incident.
Mm-hmm.
He also signed a bill by Senator Hannabeth Jackson of Santa Barbara, which prohibits employers from forcing new employees or those seeking raises to signing non-disparagement agreements. Those rights, however, could still be waived as part of a settlement, and that often happens in exchange for a severance package. A ban on non-disclosure agreements, where the victim can't talk about something that happened, and a ban on non-disparagement agreements, where you can't speak ill of your employer.
Because you mentioned the bill by State Senator Hannabeth Jackson, I do want to reflect on the comments that he made about the Women on Corporation bill, which was SB 826, because part of his comment was, quote, recent events in Washington, D.C. and beyond make it crystal clear that many, implying many in Congress, are not getting the message. And he applied it to that bill in particular, but you get the sense that his message could expand to that bigger look at women in the workplace, the Me Too movement. I get the sense anyway that his vision was broader horizon than just that one bill.
With the exception of climate change, it is very rare for Governor Brown to comment on national politics. He's loosened up a little bit in the last year or so, but, you know, after Trump first got elected and became president, Brown generally stayed quiet and left it to Democratic legislative leaders and others to be the most vocal against what Democrats feel is wrong about what's happening in D.C. right now. But this Supreme Court hearing, I think, had an effect on the governor because he commented briefly about it on Friday as he was walking away from an event, which he never does. He will avoid taking questions when he just goes to an event at the Capitol, gives a speech to a group and walks back in. But he commented on that. And then this veto message, as you mentioned, we should say this is a bill that requires California-based publicly held corporations to include women on their boards of directors. And the number of women depends on the size of the board. The governor actually acknowledged that the bill has potential flaws that could lead to a court overturning it. But in this case, unlike with other bills where he vetoed saying it's not constitutional, I think he signed it. Well, we know he signed it because he said in his message that he is sending a message. And he's like, look, courts have ruled corporations are people. So it's high time corporate boards include the people who constitute more than half the persons in America. And like you said, Beth, in case anyone missed his point, he CC'd his signing message to the United States Senate Committee on the Judiciary.
What was his comment Friday when someone caught him sort of off the cuff and asked him to comment about the hearing?
I wasn't there on Friday. I was on John Cox's campaign bus. He's the Republican running for governor. But according to the Sacramento Bee, he said, look, I think Kavanaugh's lies are, quote, relatively well proved, and I hope the FBI can figure that out. He also called Thursday's Judiciary Committee hearing, quote, a step toward an increasingly polarized America.
You're listening to Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief, Ben Adler. We are going through a bit of a summary for what proved to be Governor Jerry Brown's final session in signing bills as California governor. There were bills this time around that addressed police use of force,
yeah,
police policy in the state, and that really galvanized a lot of supporters and opponents. So when it was all said and done, tell me about what the governor decided to do.
A bill that would have changed the rules for when police officers can use force did not make it to the governor's desk. That was tabled in the final days of legislative session. There are going to be further efforts on a new bill because it can't be an existing bill. We have a brand new legislature getting sworn in December. And so I would expect to see groups come to the table and work on that bill with the goal of advancing it to the governor's desk, the next governor's desk, next year. There were, however, two transparency bills that made it to the governor's desk, and Brown signed both of them. There's a bill by Assemblyman Phil Ting of San Francisco that requires body camera footage to be released within 45 days of a police shooting or when an officer's use of force causes death or great bodily harm. And another bill by Senator Nancy Skinner of Berkeley allows public access to police records in use of force cases, as well as sustained investigations into on-the-job dishonesty or sexual assault. Both measures faced strong opposition from law enforcement unions, and I saw statements criticizing both actions this morning from them. But the second bill, the police records bill, was supported by the California Police Chiefs Association. They negotiated with Senator Skinner and they were able to come out with language they were comfortable with. One other point on that Skinner bill, it is retroactive. So as our colleague Nick Miller joked on Twitter yesterday, January 1st is going to be a big day for public records requests. Hopefully for everyone's sake in journalism, January 2nd, actually, because hopefully we'll all be taking a day off on the 1st.
In these final weeks leading up to Election Day and then beyond, how much do you think we're going to see and hear from this governor?
My guess would be we will see him be vocal and public campaigning against Proposition 6, which would repeal the gas tax, diesel tax, vehicle fee increases that he signed into law last year, really led the battle on, to fund transportation projects. And he has been trying to raise money for the No campaign. He does not want it to pass. And he is going to be out there, I suspect. I don't know, but I suspect he's going to be out there campaigning.
Thank you, Ben.
You're welcome.
And there's more coverage of the end of session at capradio.org. Let me alert you to Monday, October 8th. Immediately following Insight, you're going to hear the one and for now only scheduled debate between the two candidates for California governor. This will be John Cox and Gavin Newsom. The event will be hosted by KQED and moderated by senior politics editor Scott Schaefer. On Cap Radio, I will host an hour of reaction and analysis after that debate. So it all happens this Monday starting at 9. Insight, the debate, then reaction and analysis. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruya. California's House races are critical in this midterm election. Some are highly competitive, some are not, and that's the focus of the latest episode of Cap Radio's podcast, Keys to the House. Ben Adler hosted the episode. He talked with Paul Mitchell, vice president of a firm that analyzes and sells voter data to campaigns. The firm is Political Data, Inc. Also joining the conversation by phone was NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. Ben asked how many California districts are truly on the table right now, and you're going to hear Domenico answer first.
Well, at this point, like you said, there's about half a dozen. If you look at the Cook Political Report, which kind of handicaps some of these races, you've got about five or six. You've got six that are either in the Republican toss-up column or already leaning Democratic. The one seat that they have leaning Democratic already is the former Darrell Issa seat that is California's 49th congressional district that is open right now, meaning there isn't a congressman running for re-election there. So you have some of these open seats are kind of the ones that a lot of the parties think are easiest to pick off. But California really does have the biggest tranche of seats that Democrats are aiming to get. And remember, Democrats need to net 23 seats overall in order to take back the House.
Well, I definitely think, and I agree with Domenico, that you've got the Congressional District 49, which is the former Issa seat, where when you look at the primary numbers, Democratic votes in total exceeded the number of Republican votes. And that was something that was really shocking for a seat that has been essentially a safe Republican seat for years. And for context, California's members of Congress have shrunk, the Republican members of Congress have shrunk from 20 members of the 53 being Republican as recently as 2006, 19 being Republican as recently as 2012. And so now we're down to 14 Republican members of Congress. And nationally, they're looking at half of them. And some are looking even more than half of those seats.
Okay, so let's start going through some of these races, beginning with the contest that each of you just mentioned. That's the seat in northern San Diego and southern Orange County, currently held by Republican Congressman Darrell Issa, who is retiring. Trying to replace him are Diane Harkey, the Republican member of the California Board of Equalization, that's the state's tax board, and Democrat Mike Levin, who emerged from a very crowded Democratic primary field. Now, according to the California Target Book, which is tracking outside spending from independent groups, outside Republican groups have spent no money on this race. Democrats are only spending a few hundred thousand. So it seems like even Republicans are kind of giving up on this seat.
That's kind of fascinating. I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, this is a seat that leans slightly toward Republicans. You know, it's a pretty even seat as far as the number of registered Republicans and registered Democrats in it. But as far as the partisan lean, you know, this is a seat where Republicans should do okay. And the fact that it's already tipping in Democrats' direction is a real potential sign of a wave this year. You know, whether or not Democrats get there is going to be fascinating. But it all comes down, frankly, to President Trump. I mean, this election has been so nationalized, as has been the trend over so many, you know, of these last few cycles. I mean, dating back, I would say, to the 2010 Tea Party wave, where you had 40-something Tea Party freshmen come in and really reshape the Republican conference. And you've got a kind of the opposite mirror image of that this time around, where you have so many liberals more fired up to want to go vote this time around. Of course, the demographics don't always favor Democrats in these midterms, but we really do have what's shaping up to be an enormous base election where both sides are trying to turn out their strongest supporters.
The next group of districts I'm kind of calling the SoCal toss-ups, and there's three suburban seats, a couple of them in Orange County and one in northern Los Angeles County, all in roughly the same situation. They're all rated as toss-ups by the Cook Political Report. We're talking about the ones held by Steve Knight in the Santa Clarita area, Mimi Walters in southern Orange County, and Dana Rohrabacher in northern Orange County. The outside groups, generally speaking, Republicans are outspending Democrats. In the two Orange County seats, that's certainly the case. In the L.A. seat, the Dems are slightly outspending Republicans. And polls that we've seen are showing tight races all around. These are ones that I think, Domenico, you would probably say that Democrats need to fare very well in if they're going to hit 23 nationally.
Yeah, and I mean, that's exactly why you see Republicans spending as much money as they are in these districts, because they know that they have to hold these kinds of seats. And they're, by the way, very expensive. If you're going to have to, you know, take out ads in the Los Angeles media market, you know, only New York costs more money. So these are very expensive seats to have to advertise in. Republicans know that they have to hold on to a lot of these seats. And someone like Mimi Walters, for example, you know, she's somebody who has come to Capitol Hill, really has her eyes on leadership positions. She's, you know, one of the few women that are in the Republican conference, and somebody who Republicans really do want to protect and have, you know, as part of the team going forward. But again, if you do see a wave, then if you're going to see Democrats pick up those 23 seats, Democrats think they've got to get, if not all these seats, most of them.
And Paul, Democrats are not going to get to 23 just winning seats like Daryl Issa's district. They're going to absolutely need these toss-ups, at least a majority of them, to break in their favor. How feasible do you think it actually is? Because these are members of Congress who have survived the 2016 election and the 2014 election and many others.
Yeah, I think that this is definitely a challenge to get, you know, let's say two of these three, I think, would be a challenge for Democrats. Definitely they have the money and the organizing, and they've really invested in these candidates to try to do it. One of the things, especially looking at the two Orange County districts, where I see a real interesting matchup is you have Katie Porter, who's very progressive, running against Mimi Walters, who is a strong Trump supporter, and she is a strong conservative. But then in the Dana Rohrabacher seat, you have Harley Ruta, who is much more moderate. He's more running from the center, and he's running against a candidate who's not only pro-Trump, but in of himself, very extremely polarizing. And in addition to being a polarizing candidate, he actually faced a primary challenge. And we've seen this in other elections nationally, that when an incumbent faces a primary challenge, sometimes that really disrupts their ability to coalesce their base behind them going into the general election.
Frankly, Republicans nationally think that someone like Rohrabacher, if they had a different candidate, that they might actually do much better in this district, because Rohrabacher is somebody who's gotten a lot of attention because of ties to Russia. I mean, Kevin McCarthy, for example, you know, the number two in the House, said that there are only a couple people who he thinks might be on the payroll of Russia. He said President Trump and Rohrabacher are among them. Of course, later he said he was joking.
To that point, if you put Kevin McCarthy in this district, I don't think Democrats would have as much of a chance. Uh-huh. So Dana Rohrabacher is the type of candidate that I think has given himself a greater challenge than, you know, just an average kind of generic Republican. So when we talk about the idea of a generic Republican ballot, I think Dana Rohrabacher would probably underperform that, whereas Mimi Walters might overperform that.
Next, I want to go to what I'm calling the lone Central Valley battleground. Some Democrats would not agree with that statement, but I'm curious to see what each of you gentlemen think. I'm talking about the 10th Congressional District in the Modesto area. Incumbent Jeff Denham against Josh Harder, the Democrat who emerged from a crowded primary. This one is largely rural, and so you've got different dynamics in play that might be more similar to some of the seats in middle America states that are up for grabs.
Again, another seat that Hillary Clinton won in 2016, which of course gives Democrats some hope. And it's an even district as far as how many Democrats and Republicans are in it.
The interesting thing about Denham's district to me is how poorly he performed in the primary. It was a situation where the total of his Republican votes versus the total of votes for the Democratic candidates, he actually had a higher number, but only by a small margin. And part of the concern, I think, for Republicans in this district is that Denham, by kind of tacking a little bit more to the center, being pro-DACA, being sympathetic to, you know, immigration concerns within his district might have alienated some of the more conservative pro-Trump voters in his own district. Now, the interesting thing is, going to the general election, a traditional strategy would be exactly that. Traditional strategy would be to try to, you know, moderate. And it's potentially the fact that Denham's weakness in the primary is exactly the recipe for him to be more successful in the general.
That's fascinating because, you know, I think so much of the problem for a lot of moderates in this election cycle is that you have so many people, voters, who are unwilling to take half a loaf. They don't want to hear about compromise. And this is something that we've seen on the Republican side for quite some time, and now starting to become something with progressives who are kind of tired of the traditional establishment Democrats. And you're seeing much more polarized elections, and moderates, you know, either Dems or Republicans, like Denham as a Republican, having a more difficult time keeping an alliance together.
The national numbers right now, as we tape this on Tuesday morning Pacific time, the president's job approval rating is 43%, Real Clear Politics average, 53% disapprove. And the generic ballot test is 49% Democrat, 41% Republican. To what extent will those numbers help shape the California congressional races?
Well, I mean, if we think all these races have been nationalized, then in a big way, obviously. I mean, and not to mention California was a state that went overwhelmingly, obviously, for Hillary Clinton and for Democrats. And you have a huge part of the resistance there. And, you know, presidents historically don't do well in their first midterm. And especially when they're under 50%, it's even worse. And the reason for that is because the out party has all the energy and has all the enthusiasm. And President Trump has alluded to that before. And with so many of these House districts that are so key to whether or not Democrats take back the House, you can bet that a lot of this is going to matter in California.
Yeah, and one of the things historically looking at California elections, there has been this idea that the national waves kind of stop at the Nevada border. We saw in 2006, Democrats made huge gains. That was actually the last year that Republicans won statewide offices, and Republicans actually gained a seat in the state legislature in that Democratic national wave year. In 2010, which was a Republican wave year, where we saw hundreds of Republicans win Democratic-held seats, in California, we were the only state that actually had a pickup, where we had a Democratic member of the legislature now win a previously Republican-held seat. So when we see these national numbers, I think California has to be viewed in its own as kind of its own political ecosystem. And we do have these districts in play, but it's not necessarily going to be tied just in the same linear kind of direct fashion to what's happening in the other 49 states.
That was part of the latest episode of Cap Radio's podcast, Keys to the House. You heard Ben Adler talking with Paul Mitchell of Political Data, Inc., and NPR's political editor, Domenico Montanaro. You can find the podcast at capradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. The popular band Rituals of Mine is heading out on tour with the band Garbage for the 20th anniversary of the album Version 2.0. Tonight, October 2nd, Rituals of Mine will headline a hometown appearance at Goldfield Trading Post, and in the studio to catch us up on what's been a very busy year is singer Tara Lopez. Hi, thanks for stopping by.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
How's this year been for making music?
It's been a whirlwind. It's been really incredible and inspiring and just, you know, everything I've been processing for the last 2 years, just everything that's been going on and putting it into the new album. And it's been an incredible focus this year.
What's your mindset been? Up, down, creative, performance focused?
Oh, gosh, all over. Yeah. Highs, lows, performance, recording. I've really made the decision to take it upon myself to take charge of how I want this next record to be. And it feels so incredible having that freedom. And so I've just been really focusing on what do I want this next body of work to look like? How do I want it to feel? What do I need to express? Because I've had a lot of things happen to me over the last 3 years. And so I've really just been focusing on that.
What have you settled on? What is the new album going to look and sound like?
Well, we're releasing new material next week, actually, on the 8th. I'm really excited. It's a song called No Time to Go Numb, and it really is about, this current administration. It's about women and how society treats women. Really, this next record is about a lot of things that have been on my mind, whether it's, society-based or in my personal life, loss, trauma, grief, and also love. But also, these social issues that absolutely are, they're on my mind every single day. So it's going to be very straightforward.
What do you think's happening right now with women's voices? And you hear from an age group that I would say is sort of teens into 30s.
Mm-hmm.
What are women talking about around you?
Women are finally feeling heard. We have a long way to go, and I think that's kind of the dialogue that we are having with one another, is really having each other's backs and being there for one another. It's still very scary for women to come forward with their stories, and we all have them. And that's something that I've really been thinking about this last week, is that I don't know one single woman who has not been sexually assaulted or harassed. Not one. And just that statement alone is something that I repeat to myself every single day, and that keeps me really fired up and motivated to continue activism, whether through music or outside of that. And I think that's kind of the dialogue that we've been having, is just like stepping up for each other and just letting each other know, like, share your story if you feel so inclined. And if you do, like, we got you.
In my age group, which is farther along in years than yours, every woman also has a story, but a lot of the stories go, yeah, that happened.
Right.
I just figured, well, I had to pick up and go on from that. I didn't pause. I didn't say that it was unusual, because it just all happens. In your age group, do you think there's a chance of situations stopping or being prevented much more than they were in my generation?
Absolutely. I think, our society conditions women to, for us to just believe that this is how we should be treated, because it's kind of been how women have always been treated. But I do think with this generation, we are starting to realize, like, no, we have a voice. We're going to speak up. We're going to hold men accountable. And hopefully other men will hold their counterparts accountable. I definitely think that women are feeling more confident and more empowered. We have a long way to go, of course, as we all felt this week. But I do think that at least what I'm hearing and feeling from those around me is that we are going to continue to fight, and we're going to continue to tell our stories and make ourselves heard and just really hold men accountable.
I'm talking with Tara Lopez. Rituals of Mine plays tonight at Goldfield Trading Post. Doors open at 7:30. This is an all-ages show, isn't
it? It is, yeah. It's a very rare all-ages show for us.
Yeah. You have this project, which originally started as an experience in women living through a catcalling session. The project was called This Is What It Feels Like.
Mm-hmm.
That's morphed a little bit, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. We still continue. That's the main focus for This Is What It Feels Like, is to travel around the world and allow men to experience what it feels like to be catcalled, to be on the receiving end. But we partnered up with AT&T this summer to present This Is What It Feels Like to Be Loved, the Turn Up the Love Project. And it was specifically for LGBTQ teens in Utah. The suicide rate is amongst the highest amongst LGBTQ teens in Utah. And we really wanted to do something to kind of hopefully combat that and create a dialogue. So really, I have a lot of ideas. I want to do so much while I'm alive. And one of those ideas is to create these exhibits where we're just creating compassion and empathy, so that hopefully we can create change. Because I do feel that you see real change when people are able to experience what they don't know.
Have you seen more power in the words you speak, Tara, or in the music and the legs that the music has?
That's a great question. I think both. Just last night when we played, or the other night when we played Portland, I had a huge man come up to me in his 50s with tears in his eyes saying, "You've completely opened up something in me tonight after seeing me perform." And that was massive. I've had people after shows tell me that our music has saved their lives. which is incredible. But then also, you know, we've heard so many stories with this project. This is what it feels like, that we've helped men change their behavior. So I think, you know, I want to express myself in so many other mediums, and music is just one form of that. And if I, and it's all to serve other people. It really is to try to, if I can help other people, that's always the intent. So hopefully I'm able to do that in many ways.
Have Sister Crayon fans migrated to the audience? Do you see them there for Rituals of Mine?
Yeah, it's so awesome. Yeah. It's so incredible that I feel so, so grateful that I've been supported by the Sister Crayon longtime devoted fans, and they are evolving with me. And that's what this project is. It's still very much the root of what Sister Crayon was. It's just elevated. And it's been really cool to see the longtime fans in the crowd, along with like newer fans that are just hearing about us through the various touring that we're doing now.
We have a clip from Devoted, and I can hear your fans saying, let's get to some music. Let's hear some music. So here's a little bit.
Hop along and I'll be your devoted girl. The only. Hop along and I'll be your devoted one. The only for you. The only for you. Hop along and I'll be.
You can hear that voice and almost that exact sound tonight at Goldfield Trading Post. I'm talking with Tara Lopez. Rituals of Mine will be there for an all-ages show. Doors open at 7:30. So the new album, is there a title yet?
I have a few in my brain that I have yet to share with anyone, really. So soon, there will be music so soon. I mean, you know, next week there will be new music, but the album will come out early 2019.
Can you at least tell me the direction you're going? I expect it to be, if not a concept album, a message album.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's really about the last 3 years of my life. I've lost my father. I've lost one of my best friends. I've gained so much. Life has really 100% changed in every single way. I'm not the same person 3 years ago, and I feel very confident in saying that. And so I think this new record is going to show a progression musically, lyrically, and in my voice, just a completely elevated look as to what I've been going through the last 3 years. It's also kind of a collective look as to what I feel my friends, my group of people, and society has gone through.
There is a fieriness to your spirit right now, and some people might wonder how you weren't crushed or stomped by some of what you went through.
Oh, I was. But how I view it is, my mother raised me to, you know, just keep your head up, keep going. And I've been really focusing on talking about and taking care of myself with in regards to mental health. That's been a huge passion of mine, talking about that. And you know, I started taking antidepressants for the first time in my life exactly 1 year ago. And that's changed my life, just being open about that and talking about it. And I think for me, it's being productive is my way of healing. And so I've just kind of kept going. But there's definitely been moments of that, and you will hear that on the record. And, you know, I'm just so grateful that I have these outlets to, you know, to utilize.
Do you look at your depression as chronic, something you'll always deal with, or situational because of this capsule of time?
That's a great question. I definitely am manic depressive. My father was manic depressive, and so it definitely runs in my genes. It was something that I've always kind of struggled with, but just kind of, you know, like, oh, I have music as my outlet, and kind of just delved into that. But it wasn't until I lost my father to suicide that it forced me to take a look in the mirror and say, you know, I'm not going to go down that route. I refuse. And I'm going to, in honor of him, I'm going to take care of myself. And hopefully, you know, it's been really cool to see the trickle-down effect of seeing my friends taking care of themselves and my other family members kind of, you know, I just want to lead by example as much as I can.
Do you think that will ultimately be part of the banner you carry? Or do you see yourself going beyond that to something even bigger?
Oh, something so much bigger. I really do feel that. And I think at times, I felt that my whole life. And at times it's really scared me because, there's a part of me that's like, who am I to think that I am deserving of this? But I'm starting to really own that and know that there is a lot to me and to what I want to share with the world. And I have all of these struggles and hardships or stories that I think will help other people. So, yeah, I think that I have some big plans for sure that I'm working on.
Your vibrancy is infectious.
Thank you.
I have to say.
Thank you.
It is a great experience. I want to encourage people always to go see music live, to be in the live moment, but extend the invitation, especially tonight, for this moment of time where you are just before you jump into the next new project.
Thank you so much.
And touring with Garbage, too.
Oh, my gosh. A dream. A dream. Not only are they heroes of mine and always have been, but they're the nicest, sweetest, most genuine people who don't act like rock stars, and they totally are. And it's, I'm so humbled by the experience and so honored.
Good luck, Tara.
Thank you so much.
Promise me you'll come back soon.
Absolutely. I love it here.
The new music and new stories. Well, we love having you. Thanks again for coming by.
Thank you so much.
That is Tara Lopez. The show tonight, doors open at 7:30 at Goldfield Trading Post. And we'll have more coming up, as she said, very soon from Rituals of Mine. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Okay, you're saying, what is that? That is the sound of Gentleman Surfer, a Sacramento experimental rock band with John Bafis on drums, percussion, and vocals, Barry McDaniel on guitar and vocals, Zach Bissell on synthesizer and vocals. The band has a new record out this weekend, their fourth. It's titled Hard Pass. They're all set up to perform live. Good morning. Hello, everybody. We're going to let them jump right into it with a track from the new record. This is the song Possevader. We'll be right back. All right, that's Gentlemen Surfer. They perform at the Blue Lamp in Sacramento this Friday, 8 to 1. Pregnant and Meet Cute are also performing. Who has a mic? John?
I think we've all got one.
Okay, Zach. All right. Possevator, what does the word mean? What's the title of that song?
That was actually my daughter, Elladay. That was how she used to pronounce the word popsicle.
She came up with that on her own. Possevator for popsicle. Oh, that's great. So the new album is Hard Pass. You're self-releasing your album still?
Correct.
All right, so this one's on cassette and on vinyl?
Cassette and vinyl and
limited
digital.
Limited releases? Great. Mm-hmm. Where are you experimenting most with your sound?
Well, I guess, I mean, probably in terms of structure and the sounds that we're using with each other and the way they interact. Usually we are putting songs together with really concrete ideas in mind, especially when I'm structuring songs, for instance, and Zach, we have really direct visions for how they're being structured and how certain parts and the main melodies and stuff interact. But then we leave a lot of room for other things to kind of happen more spontaneously and create themselves, where Barry comes in and comes up with guitar parts that never would have thought
of.
He
is tearing it up over there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I would never
even break a sweat.
Write those parts, you know?
Maybe a couple of beads.
A mental sweat going on there. You too, Zach. So are you going out on tour with the new music?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I in a perfect world, yes, but in the current DIY climate, there's not really a whole lot of doesn't really make a whole lot of financial sense. We're all just, you know, working guys trying to pay our bills, and I'm trying to, you know, support my family, and unless things were to line themselves up in a way that it makes more sense, otherwise we're just losing money and generally not playing for hardly anybody on tours that we set up for ourselves anyways. That's just kind of how it goes in that.
So this is a big show then at the Blue Lamp, right, Barry?
Yeah. It's big for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, again, Blue Lamp, Friday night. You have one more song you're going to do, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if we, I thought Cody
well,
was going to have
Well, I'll tell you what I'm
going
to do. I'm going to close out the show, say thanks, everybody. That's insight for today. And we've got about 2-3 minutes. So why don't you just play us out?
Okay.
Love to hear more music. This is Gentleman Surfer. And again, John Bayfus, Barry McDaniel, Zach Bissell. And you can see them Friday night at the Blue Lamp. Thanks, guys. Glad to have you in
Thank
here
you.
Playing live today in our studio. There you go.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.